Okay. So, oh, and huge congratulations.
Well, I think are people the nominal meeting time was supposed to end at 5:30. Are people running to catch planes and things?
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people may have to catch planes. So I think that if we could keep it.
Okay.
Keep it in.
I will try and keep it
5 minutes. Or so. Well, I don't know how long. I don't know how long. Five. You have 5 minutes. You have 7 minutes.
Okay.
Just some jokes.
Okay. Well, that's the latest thing that's unexpected about this talk. It was unexpected that I should give it. I found out this morning. This is, of course, the unexpected workshop. And so let's just see. So in planning this talk, what I tried to do was the following. I tried to put together those things that I learned at this workshop that were unexpected to me and seemed to be non-trivial. And, you can see if they seem non-trivial to you, they may be wrong. I apologize that I did not use the official transcript that Jack is keeping, but I heard I'm not audible on it anyway. So. Okay. So, just to begin, there is, of course, a hierarchy of the unexpected. Many people think that the MSM, the Standard Model Higgs boson, is unexpected. Maybe even Mr. Orbach is in that category. I don't know. Some of us here expect these things, but then we don't expect things that are lower down in this hierarchy. This meeting is somewhere around here. And, of course, down here is the truly unexpected. But the summary talk, I can't say anything about that, so I'm just going to restrict myself to this one. Okay, let's talk first about Hidden Valley. So this is, of course, a very rich field. Actually, one of the things unexpected to me is how much richness there is here. And I think Matt and Catherine and other people deserve a lot of credit for bringing all this physics out. The basic idea is a new sector of physics coupled to... coupled to the Standard Model, three couplings that become active only at the TDD scale. So here is Z prime, or contact interaction. And the most interesting example is this new physics is in a strong interacting sector. If I just apply to this the physics of QCD and QCD-like gauge theories, there are several different scenarios I could have. I could have this Z prime go to 2 prions, to some number of prions in a spherical event, to QCD2 jet events, or eventually to multi-jet showers. And each of these gives a slightly different scenario, and all of which one can try to adjust through. Matt Strassler, Dan Ventura, other people have implemented this in a very concrete way in Pythia, so one can actually carry out simulations and learn what these events actually look like in particle detectors. Of course, the business of the lifetimes of these states, the long-lived nature, is very familiar to, I think, all the people at this meeting beforehand. But something that it seemed to me is an important part of the story that I certainly didn't appreciate before is the question of the mechanism by which the new sector becomes visible by coupling back to Standard Model particles. And there are all kinds of scenarios that we also have to think about. So these V hadrons in the new sector may be invisible. They necessarily have no Standard Model quantum numbers, but they can decay, but eventually they can decay to stable ones. And then for the stable ones, each one has its own idiosyncratic scenario for how it decays. So some examples here, coupling through the Higgs boson to BB bar, coupling through gamma and Z to lepton pairs or quark pairs, or coupling through the energy momentum tensor to glu-glu or gamma-gamma. And so depending on which of these routes, or maybe none of them, maybe there's a stable particle which is not on this list and just has a lifetime so long that it escapes, all of that affects the scenario. And so in addition to the familiar matrixing that we heard about before, whether the decays are prompt, centimeter, meter, or 10-meter scale, we ought to think about some matrixing in terms of the visibility of the new hadrons. So for example, maybe they're all visible. They all decay to BB bar through the energy momentum tensor. And we visualize the complete energy flow in that event through these decays. Maybe They all decay promptly, but some decay to lepton pairs and some decay to neutrinos. So characteristically, there's some missing energy. And there's also the very beautiful kinds of physics that Catherine talked about yesterday. Maybe only a small fraction of the hadrons decay visibly. Then probably the leptons get emphasized. And then they could be invisible C unparticles. So let's now go on. So there's some related ideas, one of which received a lot of discussion at this meeting. Namely, the new hadrons could have electroweak quantum numbers, and then they can be quarks. And I'll talk about quarks in a moment. The other one is that they could have QCD color, and then they are R hadrons. Now, R hadrons were not discussed at this meeting except by analogy, but they really belong in this suite of ideas. The basic properties of R hadrons is that they're colored things which are heavy. They pick up quarks and gluons to make heavy color singlet particles. The dominant energy mechanism for a slow R hadron is ionization. So the neutral ones have long decay paths, but then they charge exchange, making weird tracks with ionization and then none. They can stop in a detector. They can live macroscopic amounts of time. So all of these things are other types of unexpected physics. This is familiar in split supersymmetry models. But somehow it belongs in this same bag with other things that are hard to recognize and trigger. Okay, now quarks. These are heavy particles with confinement by new gauge interactions. So we heard about two novel signatures at this meeting. Of course, only the one that didn't come from Davis is highlighted. Please excuse me. Mm-hmm. The quarks with microscale confinement. So then you have quarkonia. They oscillate, they de-excite by emitting blue balls of the new sector or photons. There's this study by Harnick and Wisansky of what it looks like if, let's say, 10% comes out in photons and makes a radiation pattern in the inner detector. And we talked about whether that could possibly be seen above pi 0 to 2 gamma from minimum bias events. It's also interesting to think about whether the new blue balls could decay visibly, providing some other aspect of the visualization of the quark de-excitation. And then there's a talk about quarks with macroscopic confinement, macroscopic strings. Marcus discussed that this morning, and I don't understand it, so I'm just going to go on. Unparticles. So then the new particle sector is a conformal field. John had a classification this morning where he tried to put unparticles together with Hidden Valley in a certain theorist's menu, but I prefer this way of thinking about it. If the conformal symmetry is exact, unparticle stuff is invisible. Then it's only missing energy signatures. Missing energy is basically determined in unparticle theory in a very beautiful way that Jonathan Feng emphasized to us by the conformal dimensions of operators in the new sector. So as long as you're looking for signals where everything is invisible, there's lots of very beautiful quantum field theory, but relatively few observables. On the other hand, the conformal symmetry is very likely to be broken. And for me, I guess, even broken at the GeV or 10 GeV scale. If the conformal breaking goes up to the 10 GeV or higher scale, then you're back in the situation that I talked about with Hidden Valley, where the stuff, the high energy stuff, decays to some stable particles. And then we have to ask each stable particle how it decays back to the standard model. And then there is the list of stories that I gave you for the Hidden Valley scenario, which basically is a panoply of scenarios that you can consider. So at this stage, unparticle physics looks very much like Hidden Valley physics in the concrete way that it's modeled by the same kinds of Monte Carlos and the same kinds of benchmark problems. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about theory. So now let me go into things I learned or hope to learn about the experimental aspects of this problem. So the first one, which I've been told many times but which can't be underemphasized, is this statement. If the event is not triggered, it did not happen. So it's very important to figure out how, whether we will actually trigger on unexpected events, get them into the data stream where eventually one can learn about them. However, the outcome, what I learned from this meeting about whether we will actually trigger on unexpected events, it's a very complex story, and one which I guess in the remaining 2 minutes I don't have much time to explain. So very briefly, if an event is analyzable, it contains some physics object that aggregate to hundreds of GeV of energy. So they're there somewhere. So the question is, will they pass the trigger? If the trigger is sufficiently robust, they will, but there are two situations one should be aware of. The first is that the event might be in many low-energy clusters, like in this example of the photons and the quark scenarios. So they may not be individual objects, and you might need a different strategy. I think in that case, I don't understand how to trigger on it, except using external signals like ISR or a heavy high-energy lepton in the final state. But the other one is that the energy might be an object that might not meet quality requirements. And this is something about which we had much discussion, especially after Kyle's talk. Things that are out of time, tracks that don't point to the vertex, calorimeter showers that begin halfway through the calorimeter, etc. The answer that I got eventually seems to be the following, that initially we use robust inclusive triggers so that if hundreds of GeV of energy are there, it's recognized by the trigger and you trigger on it. But then you learn about the actual beam detector and noise conditions, and you start putting tighter and tighter quality requirements to get the rates down. This is known in the trade as defense against the dark arts. So now you have very subtle new requirements that eliminate the robustness, and by Murphy's law, especially for those unexpected modes that you would hope to be able to trigger on with the robust generic triggers. So the answer here is that one actually needs benchmarks, and that advocates of the unexpected must continually be vigilant that some new requirements are not put that eliminates their physics. Unfortunately, I don't know a more concrete way to express this. There are two footnotes here. First of all, the importance of diagnostic triggers. This actually came up in Greg's talk as well. A lot of the triggers that we talked about at this meeting turned out to be triggers that are included mainly to monitor noise levels and performance. And those are often interesting triggers because they evade some of the quality requirements that keep us from discovering the unexpected. So it seems important to be aware that these diagnostic trigger streams are very important. And hopefully the experimenters, because I think this is totally beyond the capability of theorists, should know what those are in detail and whether they're useful for this unexpected physics. The second is a comment about analysis methods. In many cases, the unexpected physics requires non-standard analysis methods. But Gordon told us that we shouldn't worry about that. If you get it on tape, I hope, will figure out how to find the physics in there.
You
okay. One of the very interesting things that I learned at this meeting is the subtlety of the production stage. And this, I must say, was completely new to me, so maybe it's new to many of the other theorists in this room. After triggering, in the processing from the raw data to the analysis stage, physics objects that are not sensible are, or maybe I should say may be, dropped from the record. Tracks out of time, tracks that don't point back, etc. The hits can be dropped in the record, which is actually analyzed by the experimenters. The information can be recovered, but only in reprocessing, which may not happen until many years later. So it's actually interesting to think about whether there are classes of events that are recognized at the trigger level that could be flagged either for special processing or for priority reprocessing. And I'll have a comment about that a little later. For example, events with multiple out-of-time tracks or out-of-time calorimeter jumps. So, or events of high weirdness in the sense that Greg was talking about. I would like to emphasize the importance of measuring the structure of minimum bias events. Fortunately, I don't have time to explain what is in this plot, which I got from Ian Hinchliffe. But what it is supposed to demonstrate is the uncertainty in, for example, the multiplicity of secondary particles in a minimum bias event as predicted by three totally reasonable codes that are fit to the Tevatron data. And so one of the very important tasks for the early days of LHC running is to really get enough data on minimum bias events that we can find out what they look like. They're expected, I think, especially in this Pythia tuned to the Tevatron data, to be very jetty, maybe even with multiple of order 10 jet pairs in them. They should have multiplicity fluctuations that are localized in eta. All those things make it more difficult to actually recognize correctly the unexpected. It's interesting to get a sample of 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 min bias events at 14 TeV. To really
but
try and understand.
That number, why 10 to the 8 and not 10 to the 6?
I'm sorry. 10 to the 7th is 1 per second. The number 10 to the 8th is advocated by Burkane, so now I'm advertising for you.
So, both experiments actually appreciated this point very much, and in fact, we rely on mean bias for early calibration of the effects like calorimeter. So, the first thing we're going to collect is mean bias, and then there are serious studies on how to make true minimum bias triggers, so that you bias events. Well, any trigger bias can be done by definition,
right.
But you need to find a way to bias it in the most minimum way.
Excuse me, I'm almost done. The next of these, I hope, motherhood statements is the importance of the ISR tag. A reaction with S hat greater than Q squared typically contains an ISR jet with ET greater than alpha S times Q. And so this is the trigger of last resort. If there is a 3 TeV Z prime in the event, there is a hard jet with several hundred GeV of ET. And as a single jet trigger, it doesn't make any requirement on other aspects of the event. So it's very interesting to have a single jet plus anything trigger. And I think it's very important also for theorists to study the properties. What's the jet multiplicity in ISR? Are there things there that people have been studying ISR for decades, but maybe there are still things we need to understand better. This is a figure, by the way, from some study of split supersymmetry, giving the rates for passing a certain ISR trigger as a way of recognizing those events. I also think we need to worry about the processing of events accepted with the ISR trigger. Maybe events that pass with the single jet trigger alone ought to be flagged for potential reprocessing in the way that I talked about. Now, I just have one.
Why do you say that?
What?
Why do you say it's important to reprocess?
Oh, because. So these are events that are accepted with a high PT jet, which presumably came from ISR, recoiling against some potentially unknown physics. So. In that case, we didn't put any requirements in the trigger on the unknown side. And so then we're probably in the most danger that contains physics objects that might not be recognized in the initial processing, that might not be standard model. Okay. The connection of unexpected physics to Z-prime physics. This is a very important point in Matt and Catherine's stuff, which I think didn't get enough emphasis at this workshop. One of the key aspects to the Hidden Valley and similar models is that there has to be a messenger that goes there, and that messenger is likely to be a Z prime. The Z prime is one of the things that's in the early physics for LHC. The early physics measurements are sensitive to a Z prime up to 2 to 3 TeV. So if that particle is found, that would really be a key that we have to think much more seriously about all the issues raised at this workshop. Because that might be a bridge to some genuinely new sector of particles. Also, the Z prime gives a lot of information. If you assume that new physics goes through a Z prime, it gives a lot of information. You have a definite S hat, you have a characteristic scale for the ISR, you know the production is central. It affects really the way you would do the analysis. And so I think the discovery or non-discovery of the Z prime in this mass region would really be a crucial thing as to how seriously we're going to take this kind of physics and how we're going to do the analysis. And then I have, I think, just one more comment to make. which is a comment about the far future. Hadron colliders at 100 TeV, which for lack of regional bias, I will call the L2, L squared HC. At the next generation of Hadron colliders, we'll be trying to access the 10 TeV scale. And we'll be thinking about the issues that is the essentially the high energy physics of which the physics we're talking at this model are the low energy effective theories. So that's a rather challenging problem. We're talking about cross sections that are at the 100, at now the Attobarn, 100 Attobarn level. We'll need luminosities of something like 10 to the 37. On the other hand, the total hadronic cross sections remain at the 100 millibarn level. So we'll be talking about thousands or 10,000s of pileup events. Also, to get this kind of a luminosity, things will have to be very tightly focused, so the beam sizes in Z will be shorter, and that adds to the problem of pileup. The strategy then must be design a trigger that is highly selective for the special things that we find at the LHC and the TeV scale. Look at those events, get them offline, and then, in the huge amount of computer power that will be available in this era, try and select the interesting part of the event from under the 1,000 or 3,000 pileup events in which it is born. And the obvious conclusion from that is that at the L squared HC, the only things we will trigger on are the signatures discussed at this meeting.
These figures should be waterproof because you would have to period it after this water so that it doesn't melt.
Very good.
So David Stewart has the final word from the experimental.
That was the last word.
It's a very short talk, but
he emphasized to me that it was not last words.
Yeah, actually, so Robin just said final word, and I like that much better than what I had thought it was going to be, which was final words, which is ominous. ominous to say the least. So, I want to give just sort of some perspective, my perspective, which is not necessarily shared by the other experimentalists, but should be, of what I think of I've how stimulating this workshop has been and what I think it needs me to. So to start off, first of all, I really like the format of open discussion, especially for these kinds of models where it allowed some deeper discussion so that we could really, so that I, as an experimentalist, could really understand some of the issues in these new ideas, at least they're new to me, which makes it fun. I really enjoy puzzling through these new models. And that, I think, that sort of interaction between this side of the table and that side of the table is not as common.
You picked the wrong photo, though, because these guys don't have ears. They only have
actually, mouth. That's why I picked this photo. So this is one of the egghead sculptures from UC Davis. It's actually just right over here. And it's two guys, I only could find a picture of one of them, face to face, yelling at each other, and they have no ears, so they're not listening. But actually, and sometimes that's what the two sides of our field can be.
This is in front of the law school.
Kind of close to the physics department.
Yeah. We got around that, and I think it's because of the way that this was organized. And I want to thank the Hefty and the other organizers for doing that, because it gave us a chance, at least for a short time, to actually have some ears talk to each other now, and actually hopefully spin off these conversations and continue to talk to each other. So thank you.
Is that you?
No, it's not. I don't know who it is. This just Google gave me this 5 minutes ago.
You should say yes.
Yeah. I ran out just 2 minutes ago. So this interest in these new ideas is because they're fun puzzles. They're very interesting to learn about just because it's new physics. It may not be the physics we actually have, but it's still interesting. It's a fun puzzle. And it gives us signatures that I think are new and different. maybe we've seen them before, but it brings them back to the front. And I think a lot of the experimentalists in here are signature-driven. An example of a trigger bias that we spent the afternoon talking about. The experimentalists here mostly came because they're interested in this kind of thing, the signature-based searches. And the problems we talked a lot about was how, actually, now when we go to the actual experimental trigger, how do we find these signatures? If you want to trigger an analysis that is signature-based, there's two ways to do it. You look for a signature that is a combination of standard model objects, two photons and missing energy, four leptons. And so you just trigger on some combinations of standard model objects. From the trigger's point of view, this is actually the standard menu of objects in the trigger. And the quirky things, like strange curvature, for example, is very non-standard model, and it's not in the standard menu unless you go and put it there. So to get the standard model physics that you want, as has been said a couple of times, you have to work hard to reject anomalous things, such as if you're looking for quirky curvature for a muon, well, there's a lot of anomalous backgrounds to muons, and you have to reject them to get the standard model objects. If you now want to get the non-standard menu objects, you have to do something different. And if you don't, they will be rejected, and so you have blind spots. This is actually a zoom of one of these sculptures. Not only does it not have ears, one of its eyes is closed. So, you know, if we don't look, as Michael said, if you don't look, it's as if it didn't happen. So how do we get around blind spots? We spent some time talking about that, and I think that they split into two. There's some that are just plain impossible. There are some that are possible, interesting, but they're risky. Because if you want to do them, you have to really focus on them. That is, you have to work as hard on these non-standard menu objects to keep the backgrounds down as everyone else is, rejecting the physics you're interested in to get the physics they want. You have to work just as hard on this. And when I say you, I mean somebody has to take this. This is a responsibility. You need a person who grabs this and says, this is the physics I really want to do, and works hard on it, and keeps working on it, because as the luminosity goes up, all of a sudden new problems come in, and you have to come up with a new clever trick to reject the anomalous backgrounds to your search for something that is anomalous. And in the process, I think you need to avoid focusing so much that we develop new blind spots. Maybe that would be a beyond the standard model bias. This is a full-time job for an experimentalist. It has a lot of challenges. And it's actually, it's real work. It's the whole job. In the past, in the pre-corporate phase of experimental particle physics, this is the way it was done. You would get together with a group of colleagues, theoretical and experimental colleagues. This is before my time. This is how I heard from the romantic stories of how it used to be in the cowboy days before we wore suits and acted like lawyers, that you would come up with an idea you wanted to test. And you meant theory and experiment. And you figured out how you could do that, and you would submit a proposal to the laboratory for beam time. If you were approved, you would build an experiment, you would run it, you'd write reconstruction software, and then you'd do the analysis. And that's actually exactly what you have to do now for these non-standard searches. If you want to go look for a weirdly curving muon, you have to go back to the pre-corporate approach to physics, which is make a proposal for trigger time, and maybe even build the missing piece of the detector. Henry had the example of time of flight. That has been done, for example, in CDF, and there's some papers that are coming out, and they would not have been done were it not for the proposal to build that piece of the detector, and the trigger, and then do the analysis. You probably have to, well, maybe not write the reconstruction, you have to rewrite it, which is probably even harder than writing in the first place, because you have it. And then you do the analysis. So these are experiments within a collaboration, just as you used to have experiments within a lab. And I find this sort of thing very exciting. It's actually really, it's a fun way to do things. But it's a lot of work, because you have to work, you have to do every piece of the experiment yourself. And to do that, actually all along, you have to understand things, so there's this need for constant focus on what you really worry about, but not focusing so much that now you develop blind spots to something. And that's, I think, another example of this important theorist-experimentalist collaboration. Not theory-experiment, but a theorist and an experimentalist. The discussion we've had in the last couple of days, I think, is fantastic. It's the kind of thing that does this, and I think conversations are going to spin off that are more one-to-one and keep going. Actually, I hope that Hefty can bring another one of these together. This is the kind of stuff that I think allows us to do that. And we keep going. So, final words. I like the title of the workshop, Discovering the Unexpected. So we had a list of a lot of things that you could call unexpected, but now we know about them, they're not unexpected anymore. So rather what they are, we realized a lot of these are easily overlooked rather than unexpected. And so the challenge, I think, is what we need to do now is look over what's been overlooked and make sure that we look at it. Thanks.
I just want to say thank all of you for coming, and especially all the experimentalists. I don't know how many times I was told that this thing will never work because experimentalists will never show up, and I mean, what can I say? Thank you very much.
Thank you.